Good evening. I'm deeply honored to be here, my first time at this great university, place of higher learning. I have to tell you that in journalism, each day is an education. You never cease to broaden your horizons, and I guess I could never ask any more of any profession. Problem is, you never learn enough, and you never know all the answers. Of course, more people feel they know who is going to win the presidential election than the World Series. As far as most of the pundits and the political pros are concerned, however, the ball game is over, with President Reagan leading by a wide margin. Of course, the big news from Washington and everywhere else in the country is this election, with several more weeks to go before the outcome is determined. As far as many of the pundits are concerned, as I said, Reagan has, in some places, as much as a 15 to 20 point lead. But then Reagan remembers when Harry Truman was supposed to be dead in the water in 1948, only to conduct a rip-snorting whistle-stop campaign across the country, and he proved the pollsters wrong. Whether Walter Mondale can pull it off remains to be seen, but anything can happen with the volatile electorate. The two campaigns are a contrast with Reagan's re-election campaign, well-oiled, well-heeled, and smooth-running. The Mondale camp is still feeling its way, probing for good issues, trying to pick up the pieces from the divisive primary campaign and blunders at the San Francisco convention. The nomination of Geraldine Ferraro for the number two spot on the Democratic ticket has been a plus in generating excitement, and she has been a crowd drawer. Her financial troubles gave her supporters pause, not to mention second thoughts on her own part. And of course, the targeting in by the church and the far right on her abortion position has been painful for her. But anyone who runs for public office today has got to know their life will be an open book, their bank accounts, their families, their past conduct. Nothing is sacrosanct. The president has a lot going for him with an upbeat economy. If the polls are true, blue-collar workers who were jobless in the Reagan recession era for 3 years are now ready to vote for him because they have jobs now. And if, as the cliche goes, voters do vote their pocketbooks, it's a plus for him. The president is playing heavily on the theme that he is offering hope, new patriotism, and a return to the traditional values of God and family. His opposition, he contends, is despairing and filled with doubts. Reagan is Mr. Feelgood President, while Reagan is warning voters that the nearly $200 billion deficits are bad for the country, that relations with the Soviet Union couldn't be worse, and that Reagan's policies are unfair to the poor and make the rich richer. Somewhere along the way to the forum, the usually untouchable issue of separation of church and state has become a flaming issue with indications that Reagan would like to change the subject. The president is politically close to the evangelical right. He proudly calls himself a conservative, and when he spoke to an ecumenical gathering at the Republican convention in Dallas, he devoted a major speech to the thesis that religion and politics are necessarily related. He was quoted verbatim, but surprised at some of the repercussions. He claims that his views were distorted by the press. At any rate, perhaps both sides have decided to back away from a very touchy subject. It also appears to be a campaign that could become nasty. Reagan calls Mondale very disparagingly, what's his name? Ferrero says the president's policies do not represent those of a good Christian. The president also has going for him the nice guy image. People like his personality, his geniality, and the impression of leadership. He delivers a speech well and has a stable of speechwriters waxing poetic about the America of the future if Reagan is reelected. As for the homeless, he says they sleep on grates by choice. He also has a good sense of humor, as reflected when he told his wife, "Honey, I forgot to duck," when he was shot by a potential assassin, or when he looked up at the nurses and doctors attending him in those dire moments at the hospital and said, "If I had gotten this much attention in Hollywood, I never would have left." The president has an operating style that keeps him above the fray and less accountable. He has been called the Teflon president because none of the unsavory happenings in his administration involving some 40 top appointees who have had to resign or been fired under a cloud have really rubbed off on him. He delegates duties to a palace guard, and he has a plaque on his desk which reads, "There's no limit to what you can accomplish if you don't care who gets the credit." In his speeches, he boasts about the invasion of Grenada, a dot in the Caribbean, and he forgets to mention the debacle and the retreat from Lebanon. But that's par for the course. Every president wants to put his best foot forward and to portray himself in the best light. It's up to the press to give the true picture, and much stands in the way of that happening. There has been managed news in every White House I've covered, but the Reagan folks have it down to a fine art. And for the campaign, they are giving reporters an even wider berth. The president has not had a full-fledged news conference since July 24th. Clearly, they do not want anything to rock the boat, any misstatement, since they believe it is only an election for him to lose. So they don't want to take any chances. Occasionally, a question is thrown at the president as he heads for a helicopter, but his aides make sure that the motors are running and loud. They have so circumcised his comings and goings to keep reporters at a distance, and they pick and choose what events can be covered at the White House in the so-called theme of the day, with the only question in mind is, will it make the evening news on television? In short, the president is encapsulated, and with all the perks of the incumbency, he can campaign from the White House as well as on the road. He panders to as many, if not more, special interests as his opponents. He likes being president. He does not see it as the loneliest job in the world or the splendid misery as his predecessors have described it through the years. As one comedian put it, "I sleep better at night knowing that the president is sleeping." He does not sweat out the job. He takes his decision-making in stride because of his own sense of confidence and self-righteousness. While others have agonized, the president has few doubts, and that apparently is appealing to those who want to believe that all is right with the world. He's not unlike other presidents who seek to blame the press for words they wish they had never spoken. "Kill the messenger who brings the bad news" is as old as time. The president gave a voice test for a radio program, quipping that he had just signed legislation outlawing Russia forever, and the bombing would begin in 5 minutes. "If you hadn't reported it," he told reporters, "nobody would have known I said it." Last fall in Japan, Reagan gave a reception for the press, and in brief marks, he extolled the freedom of the press and, quoting Jefferson, as saying that if he had a choice between newspapers and government, he would not hesitate to pick the former. Afterwards, the reporter asked him, well, what about Grenada, freedom of the press, not letting the press cover the invasion, if he felt so strongly about Jefferson's words? And he replied, Jefferson would have lost the war. We are the nemesis because we are the watchdogs obeying the Supreme Court dictum that a constant spotlight on public officials lessens the possibility of corruption. Presidents, of course, are a study in contrast. Each puts his own stamp on the White House, and each hopes to go down in the pages of history for greatness. But greatness calls for presidents to rise above themselves and to rise to unforeseen occasions. Sometimes they have. One man with courage is a majority, and often one hopes that a president will be that kind of person. One thing I've learned in my years at the White House, and particularly in the era of the Watergate scandal, all roads lead to Rome. The White House gives the orders, sets the tone, and it's the president's political philosophy that prevails. In the end, it's only the president who must, above all, be credible and accountable. I saw two presidents, Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, go down the drain because they had lost their credibility and they could no longer convince or persuade people or govern. Johnson over Vietnam and Nixon in the Watergate scandal. As for the press, we defend the people's right to know almost everything. We know that information is golden. It's the sine qua non of giving people choices before they are faced with a fait accompli. We also know that in the eyes of many, the role of the press is dubious, and that we are self-appointed watchdogs of democracy, anointed by none, feared by some, and guided, we hope, by one main ethical goal, to pursue the truth wherever it leads us. I can assure you, there is no joy in the fall from grace of any president. On the other hand, there is some satisfaction in knowing that there are safeguards against the abuse of power, and that no man, not even a president, is above the law. The president is trying to bring back the kind of America that he nostalgically remembers from the past. But he also has brought us a vision of Star Wars with his hopes for the creation of the ultimate weapon in space that would give the United States a total shield against enemy missiles, something many scientists say is not possible. And in projecting this brave new world, perhaps the superpowers should remember the philosophy that has prevailed for the past 40 years, and that is that the greatest deterrent to nuclear war is mutual fear, or what Winston Churchill has called the sublime irony of mutual terror. And it reminds me of the 8-year-old boy who was asked what he wanted to be when he grew up, and he replied, alive. And how we all remember when Jimmy Carter became the laughingstock of the country, for recalling during the debate in 1980 with Reagan that his daughter came home from school one day and said, Daddy, what's a megaton? We reporters are tested daily for our devotion to accuracy and our profound responsibility to the American people. We too are subject to a public judgment. Our report card is on the front page every day. And when we fail all. But the importance of a free and robust press cannot be underestimated. Clearly, no dictatorship can tolerate a free press or survive under one. As you can see, I don't waste any sympathy on presidents, particularly since I think that they enjoy one of the greatest honors that can be bestowed on anyone, and that is the trust of the American people. I'll go with Jeff Carter, the president's youngest son, who walked over to a group of reporters and cameramen in Plains, Georgia, on a Christmas day as they were watching Carter play on the front porch with his grandchildren and playing for the cameras. Don't you feel sorry for your father? The burdens, the press always watching, Jeff was asked. No, he replied, he asked for it. I've always felt greatly privileged to cover the White House and to watch history in the making, knowing that human beings live there with their joys, their sorrows, and their rare nobility. At the same time, I know that every president has had his troubles with the press dating back to George Washington. In our press room at the White House, there's a photograph of FDR with the inscription to reporters from their devoted victim. Truman said, "When the press stops abusing me, I'll know I'm in the wrong pew." Kennedy said, "I'm reading more and enjoying it less." What LBJ said is unprintable. And once, when we walked into the cabinet room for a picture taking, Nixon looked up and said, "It's only coincidental that we're talking about pollution when the press walks in." And Carter always seemed to be saying, "Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do." As for Reagan, well, it's like those silent movies. He thinks that we should be seen and not heard. And when the Sandinistas fired on a press helicopter near the Honduran border several weeks ago, Reagan commented, "There's some good in everyone." I think that Amy Carter kind of summed up the attitude toward the media when her mother escorted her to school on the first day of class after the Carters had moved into the White House. And the press had been alerted that they could record this great moment in history and never harass Amy again. There also was the element that the Carters wanted to show that she was attending an integrated public school, just like the common folks. Walking down the path, Amy looked at the reporters and cameramen flanking the walk and whispered to her mother, "Mom, do we still have to be nice to them?" As the campaign goes into full swing, we are indeed hearing from the candidates vis-a-vis the press. Vice President Bush really blew a fuse the other day when pestered with a question on his stand on abortion. And in his anger, he told reporters that they should be writing the good news and promoting the Reagan-Bush ticket. Exactly, of course, what reporters are not paid to do. Ferrero has had her moments, too. She looked at a cubby of reporters following her at an airport and told an aide, "God, these people are crazy." I have many memories in covering the White House. There have been times to laugh, times to cry, times to wonder. I remember when John F. Kennedy gave a dinner for the Nobel Prize winners. Lifting his glass in a toast, he said, "Never have so many intellectuals gathered under one roof since Thomas Jefferson dined alone." And I remember when scientist Linus Pauling, also a Nobel winner, picketed the White House that very day with a "Ban the Bomb" sign, went back to his hotel, changed into a tux, came back to the White House for the Nobel dinner. And I did think that that was a shining moment in democracy. And I remember once when we were riding on Air Force One and Kennedy came back, talked to the reporters, and they teased him and said, "What if the aircraft went down?" And he said, "Well, I know one thing. Your name will be just a footnote." And I remember when Martin Luther King walked through the receiving line at the White House one day and Kennedy said to him, "I have a dream." And I remember when Sarah Vaughan sang at the White House and then danced with Johnson and Hubert Humphrey. And later the black singer tearfully told us, 25 years ago, I couldn't sit down in a restaurant in this town. Or when a rabbi spoke at the Martin Luther King rally and said that the greatest sin of all in the Nazi era was silence. Or when Nixon said that on the person-to-person handshaking on the campaign trail, he said, "All the while you're smiling, you want to kick them in the shins." And I remember when Johnson was taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital for gallbladder surgery. The psychiatric ward had been transformed into a press room. What happened to the patients? Johnson asked Bill Moyers, his press secretary. We gave them all press cards, said Moyers. And I remember at a dinner at the LBJ Ranch when Johnson asked Moyers, a defrocked Baptist minister, to say grace. Moyers bent his head, began to pray, and Johnson commanded, "Speak up, Bill. I wasn't talking to you, Mr. President," Moyers replied. And I remember Liz Carpenter, who was Lady Bird Johnson's press secretary, who said, "No kind deed goes unpunished." And then there was Martha Mitchell, a voice crying in the wilderness, who said, "Politics is a dirty business." Or her husband, John Mitchell, the Attorney General, who said, "Watch what we do, not what we say." And I remember Midge Costanza, who said, "I don't mind Carter being born again, but did he have to come back as himself?" And I remember asking Billy Carter if he had been born again, and he said, "Once is enough." And I remember Miss Lillian, the late mother of President Carter, who was asked during the 1976 campaign, "Aren't you proud of your son?" And she said, "Which one?" And it was Miss Lillian who said, "Sometimes when I look at my children, I wish I had remained a virgin." And I recall interviewing Miss Lillian in Plains in 1976 when Carter was running for the presidency. And she told me of a French woman correspondent who interviewed her a few days earlier and persistently asked her about Carter's promise never to lie. She asked Miss Lillian finally, "Do you lie?" And Miss Lillian said, "Well, I might tell a little white lie." And finally, in exasperation, the correspondent said, "Well, what do you mean by a little white lie?" Finally, in exasperation, Miss Lillian said, "Do you remember when you came through that door and I told you how beautiful you looked?" Well, that's a little white lie. And in the world of interesting people, there was Henry Kissinger, a man with a mammoth ego. A woman ran up to Kissinger once and said, "Oh, Dr. Kissinger, thank you for saving the world." He said, "You're welcome." And once Kissinger teased the Secret Service agents that he might be kidnapped, and they told him, "Don't worry, we'll never let them take you alive." The other day, out in the Rose Garden, Sam Donaldson tossed a question at the president regarding, I guess, the Gromyko talks. He wouldn't answer it. And so as Reagan was heading back to the Oval Office, Donaldson complimented the president on his suit. "Is that a new suit?" And the president said, "No, that's 4 years old." So after Donaldson got back to his booth, he got a call from Reagan. He said, "Really, I made a mistake. I want to be accurate. It's 5 years old." Donaldson said, "Here he could have been telling me all about arms control, and he's telling me about his tailor." We all hope for the best for any president, and therefore for ourselves. Engraved in the mantel in the state dining room at the White House, below a magnificent portrait of Lincoln, is a prayer by John Adams, which says, "May only good and wise men live here." We all hope for that, and as Samuel Johnson has said, we live from hope to hope. And Lincoln said, "Let the people know the facts, and the country will be safe." I believe that, and I believe that we should keep an eye on presidents who do have life and death power over all humanity today to keep the people informed and democracy alive. Thank you. I'm very glad to take your questions. Why he doesn't want to take follow-up questions? Well, the tradition of the follow-up was started in the Ford administration, and Reagan has taken them in the few news conferences he's had, but now he's getting very unhappy with it because he doesn't want to be pinned down. It's as simple as that. their claim is that we're trying to hog the camera and we're trying to take up too much time. But actually, his answers often call for a follow-up, and he simply does not want to amplify. Pardon? Well, I think that, you know, he's beginning to do his homework, if I understand the question, he's beginning to do his homework more. But in the beginning, his press conferences were not very good because he really had not prepared himself. Now he really goes into training as though he were cramming for a final exam. And he has briefing books this high, and they put him through the paces, and he has a rehearsal and so forth. So he's quite well prepared for us on the rare occasions when he has a news conference.
Walter Cronkite stated that in his opinion, the TV reporters and news correspondents are getting soft.
You should read my mail. Soft on Reagan?
He stated they're getting soft. He didn't mention Reagan. He just simply indicated that in his opinion, the correspondents are getting soft. They don't have the toughness of Dan Rather of days gone by.
I don't think that's true. For one thing, Reagan has held only 5 news conferences this year. And I think that they have been tough. So I really differ with Cronkite on that score. It's true that Reagan has a style. He has a way of dancing around the questions, sidestepping with all with great amiability, and he gets away with a lot because of his smile and his humor. But that doesn't mean the questions haven't been tough. A televised news conference is usually a half hour long by virtue of the fact that it's going to be on TV. I have the honor of closing the news conferences. I wear 2 watches to make sure. And there was one news conference where practically every question, wasn't last summer, the summer before, practically every question was on our buildup in the Caribbean and El Salvador and so forth. Well, Reagan was really on the ropes through the question. He did not believe that kind of bombardment of the barrage on all on one subject. At one point, he looked down at me like, you know, is it time to quit? So I don't agree with you. And also, you should see our mail. It really is. You know, how dare you speak to the president that way? How? What are you trying to do? And
well,
so forth.
The public has been sold a bill of goods. There's no question of the fact that even when Grenada was cut off as far as the press was concerned, the public agreed with the White House that you should be cut off.
Right.
And this, to me, indicates that the press is deficient in not educating the public that freedom of the press should be emphasized. If the public is willing to go along with strangling the press, that means that the press itself is not doing the job. Just as in the case of the abortion issue between Cuomo and the Archbishop, Cuomo says, don't tell the police to do the job that you should have been doing. Mm-hmm. Likewise, isn't it not true now that the press is not doing its job in educating the public to the importance of freedom of the press, as illustrated in this current campaign? The fact that the public is buying, strangling the press, and criticizing you, then the public has been sold a bill of goods, which is contrary to our founder's theology.
Right. Well, you're partly right. But when you defend yourself and defend your profession, you try to say, this is freedom of the press. It's very important that you know the facts. It's very important that you know what goes on in the White House. The President of the United States has 17 minutes to decide whether to blow up the world, literally. I mean, these are the things you want the public to know. At the same time, they want people. We're in a pendulum swing. During the Watergate era, I mean, during the Agnew kickoff of the anti-press campaign Nixon started in 69, we were really in the doghouse. People would come up and call us every kind of name. After Watergate, people would come up to reporters and say, you saved the world, you saved the country, and so forth. Now we're in a downswing, and there's always the attack on the press. It's constant. We have to steer a steady course. We have to hope that people understand we are trying to keep them informed. But we are a scapegoat. When you try to defend yourself, you really sound defensive, and they think you're trying to justify your raison d'etre instead of trying to understand that we really think that everybody should know what's going on.
There was one reporter who used to have fun with Jack Kennedy. Sarah, I think, is her first
McClendon.
Name.
McClendon.
Yeah.
And Mae Craig, two of them.
Well, I don't think I've seen Reagan recognize her but once in any press conference, and then she tore into him and in effect called him a liar.
Right.
And I don't think he's been recognized since.
Presidents don't like to call on people they think are really going to give them a hard time as such. But they do, she's kind of the enfant terrible for that reason. At the same time,